Ah, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the JRE Review. Joined this week by Todd, of course.
Hey,
and we're bringing in our buddy Aaron, who is a former Special Forces guy. So we're going to talk some Jack Carr and also delve into James Reed's Chimp Empire. Because after I watched that documentary, I was like, this seems like a full-time military operation, and I can't speak to it. So let's go.
You are listening to the Joe Rogan Experience Review Podcast. We find little nuggets, treasures, valuable pieces of gold in the Joe Rogan Experience Podcast and pass them on to you, perhaps expand a little bit. We are not associated with Joe Rogan in any way. Think of us as the Talking Dead to Joe's Walking Dead.
You're listening to the Joe Rogan Experience Review.
What a bizarre thing we've created.
Now with your hosts, Adam Thorne.
This might either be the worst podcast or the best one of all time.
One, go. Enjoy the show.
Oh, James Reed. I did not know that he did The Octopus Teacher.
Oh, buddy.
My Octopus Teacher.
That movie, which they did not talk about, but that movie, I haven't seen the Chimp movie yet. You guys both watched it, and we'll delve into that. But man, The Octopus Teacher was also such an incredible movie.
What did you like about it?
Dude, this gentleman, I can't think of his name, a South African guy, lived right on the ocean there, like near the Cape somewhere, I think it was. I can't remember. I think it was on the Atlantic. He goes every single day. He dives down, and he has no equipment, so he's using his breath. He can hold his breath underwater for like 4 minutes or something crazy.
Now, was that because the scuba equipment scared the octopus?
I think the sounds and the equipment and the bubbles and stuff for having scuba equipment just freaked him out. Yeah.
Fair enough.
But it took this guy, I mean, months before the octopus would trust him. So he would go down there and see the same octopus all the time. Every day he would go for a year. He did it for a year and they filmed every single day.
And they were best friends?
By the end of it, they were homies.
Wow.
Unreal.
What did the octopus teach him?
Well, you're going to have to watch the movie, but I mean, what I learned from it, I mean, dude, I cried, okay? It's a freaking tearjerker.
You would.
It's a tearjerker. The octopus learned to trust this guy, and, you know, I didn't realize octopuses.
Octopies.
Octopies. Octopies are extremely smart,
which
I did not know.
Yeah.
Extremely.
Extremely smart. Mm-mm. Not sure if they're any smarter than pigs. I don't know. Also heard pigs and dolphins are extremely smart. Either way, dude, they have this bond and they're friends. And by the end of the movie, this octopus trusts this human being so much that he's like hugging him. They're like literally underwater, like he's like laying on top of him.
Wow.
It's unreal.
That's cool.
But let's get into the chimps.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, he's like an animal documentarian.
Yep.
Loves it. Went over to the chimp thing. Of course, Rogan has to have him on immediately. Rogan talked about it twice, and I knew this guy was coming on as fast as you can imagine. And there he was, right? I've watched the whole thing. I watched most of it yesterday. It's pretty powerful. Like, you have no idea. Like, I don't know, just maybe the communication or like our lack of understanding of it. There is so much going on with these guys.
The depth of it. I mean, for me, it was watching how similar they are to us and just being completely mind blown about their mannerisms and the way that they move through the woods, the way that they communicate together. It's just, it's almost hard to watch. It's difficult to see how close they are to us and know that they're just living in the woods doing these things.
What was surprising to you about it in terms of like your military experience? I mean, you were a Green Beret, right? So yeah. I imagine when you watch this, and I'm just guessing, But when I was watching it, it didn't seem like a bunch of dudes hanging out, right?
No.
We live pretty different lives to even our own ancestors. And I was just like, oh, this is like warfare.
Yeah, it is. And I watched it. I watched the whole docuseries twice through because the first time, I mean, I couldn't catch it all. But there were like maybe 10 moments where I stopped it, rewound it, and just was mind blown by the similarities of them living together in the woods, basically patrolling like they're in combat all the time. And so, you know, the Special Forces Qualification Course has a section of the course that's called SUT, Small Unit Tactics. It's much like Ranger School, where you're with your element, you're with your squad, and you're moving through the woods tactically. You're setting up, you're in a patrol at all times. You're setting up raids, ambushes, and you're living like you'd be living in war. And to watch these chimps do exactly what we do in the woods for small unit tactics, and you know, 7-8 is what they call it. Their tactics are so similar to ours.
So it was blowing your mind in the sense of like you would see something and you're like, I know what this is.
Well, in my mind, monkeys just lived in the woods.
Yeah. They live in the woods. From trees eating bananas.
Take opportunities to get food. There's all these times where I'm just like, yeah, they're monkeys. But no, when I watched this, it was so evident that they're living in like a small unit tactic military operation in the woods at all times. And they use hand and arm signals. They have an alpha that's like the squad leader. They have elements that essentially are expertise in whatever craft they're fulfilling within this patrol. And it was intense. There's one moment in the docuseries where they all get online to set up an ambush after a patrol. And there's another like rival chimp gang really close to them. They surreptitiously move in an element online, and they get up and they listen. And you can tell that they're like concocting some sort of plan. They're looking at each other. They're giving little hand and arm signals, gestures, facial expressions. And then one of the monkeys gives the signal to go, which is the same signal to go that we use in the woods.
Or just like waves his arm forward.
And when he does that, the rest of the chimps get online and they fucking move towards this other rival gang. And there's even a moment where the alpha chimp slaps one of the others on the back and they start screeching. And in my mind, they were like, let's fucking go. Let's do this.
And it made sense to you.
It made total sense. And I was just...
Right.
I mean, yeah, my wife and I, we saw it on Netflix. We threw it on. We thought it'd just be another nature-based documentary with some monkeys. No, dude, this is like 30 years in the making of like an immersion process of these monkeys being used to humans and them understanding that they have the ability to come in, get really close, and integrate with them. I mean, I heard the podcast and James...
Reed,
he's like, yeah, they basically didn't even acknowledge us while we were there. And they were so used to them that they just went about their business. And they did 400 days of documentation in order to create, what, like 5 or 6 episodes. Yeah, it blew my mind. And, you know, there were moments where I told my wife, like, holy shit, they are so similar to us in so many ways that it's almost difficult to watch.
Do you think that for the second season, which they have to make, instead of, so they were working with scientists, there were scientists out there.
Yeah.
And they're theorizing shit scientifically as they do. And then you've got, well, you know, they're like trying to figure out.
They're smart people.
Yeah, they're just trying to be like, all right, this is what they do, this is how they do it, but we don't 100% know why. Now you've got the film crew there, and what James was alluding to is, you know, they're seeing things differently than the scientists.
Yeah.
Because of the way, the lens that they look through. I thought to myself, and I had a feeling that you know, you being a military person would have like this different idea of like how this is going. I felt like, wouldn't it be great if for the next season they had like military people out there, right?
Yeah.
That had that experience just to see if through that lens,
yeah,
they could pick up on, because there was just a lot through the conversation where they're like, oh, we don't really know why this is. We think this is this. The scientists are like kind of understanding, especially when it came to the attacking of other monkeys.
Well, that's the problem with building data is that, you know, once you're seeing this for the first time up close and very intimate like they were, you're not looking at it through the lens of military warfare. You're basically trying to break down the habits and the, you know, the interactions that these monkeys are having with each other.
Yeah, like an ecologist.
Yeah, and I think James made the point that, like, monkeys or scientists study monkeys in, like, zoos or, you know, one at a time, but not in groups.
Right.
And not in, like, full-on patrol mode and seeing how they operate each day to survive, to find food, and to interact. And the one thing that was most fascinating was how they chose the alpha and how they interacted with each other. And, you know, I told my wife, I was like, man, that's like, that's exactly like warfare. Like, there's probably one guy that has so much responsibility that he doesn't have time to do anything else. And it highlighted that with a couple of the particular alphas that were in the groups, is that the alphas did not groom other chimps, but other chimps were honored to groom him. And it's like, you know, you can look at that however you want, but like, that dude's at the top of the food chain. He's got to make the decisions. He's got to make the moves. And he has to fight to be the alpha consistently all the time.
So what do they say? You got like maybe 6 years up there.
Yeah.
And eventually someone's going to beat the shit out of you.
And it's brutal. You are constantly, you know, proving yourself to your tribe or to your, you know, to your little group there that you are the alpha. And then, dude, the most fascinating thing about that was when one of the alphas was injured, the other chimps took an opportunity to knock him off and move up the chain.
What, he hurt his hand, right?
Yeah, he hurt his hand. He had like a broken wrist or something, and they were like, "Well, here it is." And they took that opportunity to move up and challenge him. And that's happening all the time. And that's happening all the time in the military too. Not that we like see a dude that's injured and move on to try to take his position, but dude, it's a process of finding out who has the ability, who has the, you know, who has the balls to be in that spot. You know, he was the squad leader, he was the team leader. And
yeah, ultimately it spoke to me like, you know, whether it seems brutal or not, it's like he's not as capable as he was.
No.
Right?
No.
And if you feel more capable, then take the lead.
Well, and the thing I thought about with that is like, that's not happening in the corporate space. That's not happening at your 9-to-5 job where you're like, hey, man, that manager's kind of weak right now. I'm going to go fucking take his position, or I'm going to beat him down and show him that I'm more capable.
That'd be sweet, though.
That doesn't do that.
Let's
I mean,
go.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, Jesus.
At least do some pull-up competitions every once in a while. I mean, come on.
But what I told my wife is that, you know, those managers and that toxic leadership that exist in, you know, in the 9-to-5 and the corporate space, they get to just sit in those positions and manipulate themselves
and be lazy
and manipulate other people. Mm-hmm. And there's no one there to knock them off their fucking pedestal.
Mm.
But in the chimp world, they do.
Yeah.
And so it's like, why don't we have a process that allows for that? I mean, maybe not, you know, beating the dude up, but like, hey, this guy's not capable anymore. Is there any type of assessment that says, you know what, this guy's, you know, ill-equipped to lead people? I've seen that nonstop in the 9-to-5. That's what keeps me, that's what keeps me out of the workforce, is that, you know, when you see a leader that doesn't have the ability to lead people and doesn't show by example, you know, there is no real process to say this guy doesn't belong here. And being a Green Beret and like moving from the teams into the corporate space, it's kind of hard to watch. But I will say that the, you know, the similarities is that if you're on a special forces team and you got 11 guys, well, you got 12 guys normally, but if the team leader, it starts to prove that he doesn't belong there, or he's you know, inefficient or is toxic to the team. I've seen it time and time again where the guys on the team, the enlisted folk, they assess that, they basically hold court and they say, listen, this guy doesn't belong here, and they package shit and put it in the hallway. So that's pretty interesting. And that's what basically happens in these chimp tribes.
Right. You can't beat his ass, but you're
good. But you can say, hey, you know what, buddy? We've all came together and we don't think you belong here, so it's time to find somebody new.
Mm. Love that. Two things I wanted to talk to you about that also were big in the documentary. One, there were the bigger apes, chimps.
Yeah, they looked different.
Right.
Didn't they?
But they weren't the alphas.
Right.
They were just patrol leaders and also like second to the alphas. So they made it a lot.
Yeah.
But they didn't have, I guess, the fear constantly of being taken over. They just kind of like hung out and did their thing and they were strong. Like, what is your take on that position? What is that?
Well, that exists in the military. I think it exists in the world in general.
Exists everywhere, right?
Yeah, it exists everywhere because it's like, man, I would imagine that they're somehow analyzing the complexity and the immense responsibility that it takes to be in that position. And they're like, you know what? I'll be a teammate and I'll do my thing, but I'm not getting my ass kicked every day.
Right.
And so with people, I think especially on teams, like you've got guys that are naturally born or have this innate, you know, instinct to lead and to be in that hard spot. And they end up being on the top. But then there's a lot of guys that don't want to have that responsibility, and they just want to show up and do their work. And so, yeah, dude, I mean, it's frightening.
What did you think about the patrols?
Yeah, right? Dude.
So these apes were just constantly patrolling.
Yeah.
They didn't talk a lot. So, again, a lot of, like, hand signals and things, and they can't figure out their communication, which is weird, right? Not weird. Like, we can't understand any animals. But, I mean, it makes sense that they don't see the value probably in any sort of language. They can make noises. They make some.
I was even thinking about that. It might be more efficient to live that way. Like, think about how loud we get in here. And, like, you can barely understand what Todd's saying because Adam's talking over him. And then I'm talking over you guys. And then I've got this idea in my head. And, like, it's kind of chaos. But if you're able to just, like, look over and say, hey, man, with a hand and arm signal or a facial expression, that might be better. Mm. You know, I've led wilderness expeditions for years, and one thing that we do is, like, for one whole day, we don't even talk. It's silence. And so we move through the woods together, we set up camp, and nobody says anything. And the efficiency and just, like, the way how smooth that runs, there's value to that. And so I told my wife when we were watching the documentary, maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe that's why they don't communicate. Mm, maybe
that's cool.
They've evolved in a way that they understand. Well, they're also being tactically efficient too. And so if they were loud and screeching and screaming and making all kind of noises, like the other tribes that are pretty close, they're going to be able to hear them.
Right.
So, you know, they're living their life. And it's so interesting because, like, the mothers and the babies kind of stay behind, right? And, like, they're like, oh, shit. When they start to see the males get all revved up and start getting crazy, they all kind of form together and say, all right, we better get the fuck out of the way because something's about to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel I got to interject just for a minute because I have not seen the film. But the most interesting part of this whole podcast for me was when they chatted about was it Pisker, the name of the...
Yeah.
Ugandan chimp that had the whites in his eyes, so it looked more human than chimp.
Oh, that was good.
Just because of the whites of the eyes, right? Was he a patroller? Was he a bigger chimp, or was he just this kind of off, like, outlier?
Well, what was interesting about him is I think he chose to patrol a lot. Like, he was, like, leading the charge mostly, but didn't have any, you know, no aspirations to become the alpha.
Right, but he had mated more than the alphas did.
Yeah, they said he
had more girlfriends.
Well, they said he spent more time building those relationships with those females in times where they weren't in heat. And so where the other monkeys or the other chimps would say, all right, you know, the women are ready to go. It's time to make some babies. This guy was, like, constantly building rapport. He was slipping into their DMs and just, like... He was making love to those chimps. Oh, like, there was something different about him.
Well, but imagine it, you think of human beings that you know that have, like, you know, sparkling eyes, I would say.
Like me.
Just like eyes that communicate, right? And people do communicate with their eyes a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and some people do it in a different way. It's like, you know, you can just look at someone, but also if you're in, you're at a party and you can be with someone that is tall and obviously confident but doesn't speak a lot, they're doing a lot of communicating in a different way.
Yeah.
And, you know, having pretty eyes kind of does it.
Yeah.
And his eyes were so different than the other chin. So it's like you could always see where he's looking, even from a distance. And, well, you know, you would imagine that sends signals.
Well, we used to have this guy on our team. We used to call him the Hawk because we'd go out to bars and he'd just sit in the corner and kind of be quiet.
Oh, it works.
And he would just watch things unfold and wait for opportunities. And so, like, where, you know, most of the guys are just like jumping in with the girls or buying them drinks, and this guy would just sit and wait.
Yeah.
And then he'd be like, oh, that girl's by herself. I'm going to go talk to her. That's what that's what he was doing.
Hmm.
He was playing his cards right.
He's being mysterious.
Yeah.
I think that this show, ultimately, if they go into two, maybe three seasons, they keep this going. Because they're so close to us, this didn't seem like a regular nature animal show. Mm-mm. To me, it was like telling us a lot about almost who we are.
No, exactly.
And you know, in a way that we're not thinking about.
Well, the most fascinating fact that they highlighted in the film was that these chimps are 99% of our genetics.
Mm.
99%. But when you look at these things' butts, you're like, dude, I'm glad we evolved into like having these normal butts, because it's just this like giant fucking weird
hemorrhoid
skin with all these lumps on it, and then there's just like an external butthole, and it's like, I'm glad we have the butts that we do. But
you don't like the look of the chimp butt?
Oh no, it's fucking disgusting.
The monkey butts are gross.
So I wrote this down towards the end. They talk about how the real chimpanzee characters. There's real characters throughout the film. Did you guys feel like these?
Yeah.
Again, coming from somebody who hasn't seen it yet,
there's
like character development through chimps that aren't speaking. You kind of know how they act and react, and you like are rooting for them or not rooting for them.
So they give the name, right?
Okay.
Yeah. And they like point to a new one, and eventually you start to remember.
You recognize.
They move different. Yeah. You can kind of like identify them after understanding what their name is and what their role is.
That's cool.
But it almost as soon as the name comes up, once it's like one or two episodes in, you're like, oh, I know what they're going to kind of act like.
Yeah. You know what their archetype is. Are they the warrior? Are they the magician? Are they the king? And you can just sit and watch them interact. And it is fascinating.
That's cool.
Yeah. And there's an elder in all these tribes. There's multiple elders. And that's the way like most indigenous tribes of people are set up, where there's like an elder that doesn't have to prove himself anymore. You know, he's already been there, done that. He might have been the alpha at one point. And one really, like, touching and pretty emotional part of the docuseries was one of the monkeys got injured during a patrol from the other chimps. He got injured bad. And so instead of him showing his weakness, he left the tribe. Mm. He moved on, and he wanted to go either heal or find a place to die. And, you know, you're sitting there watching this, and it's super sad. And you're like, dude, you could see that, like, the monkey's dying. And the elder would come in and check on him.
Hmm.
And he was the only one that was allowed to be around him. And that was fascinating to me. And, like, so that chimp in particular that got injured, he basically knew he was done. And they show him, he builds a nest for himself to die in.
Yeah,
and then the elder comes in and puts leaves over him and brush and like almost has like a little ceremony for him as he passes on.
Crazy.
It's just like, holy shit. They just held a funeral for him.
Wow.
A monkey funeral.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So much more complex.
Can't wait to watch it.
Dude, it's so good. So good. All right, let's jump over to Jack Carr and, get into more military stuff, honestly. So Jack Carr writes the books that ended up being The Terminal List, which is on Netflix with Chris Pratt. Great show, real intense, special forces related stuff. It's so interesting when these guys get out of the military and you know, have this like compulsion to write about it too? Because I bet there's a lot of pressure on that. That where I don't know. I feel like so many people have come out of the military that are special forces and want to write about it, and then they probably get a lot of pushback.
Mostly SEALs,
right? So SEALs like to do it.
Mm.
Now, is there a thing about that that you don't care for?
Yeah, there's a stigma for sure. And listen, I have a ton of SEAL buddies, and we joke around about this all the time. But a guy came into my shop one day, and he told me he was a SEAL, and I asked him when he was going to write his book, just because it's a pretty normal thing. And you know, for whatever reason, their culture has kind of set them up for it. You know, they've made a bunch of movies like Zero Dark Thirty. They made a video game about a SEAL team. And the SEALs have just been in the spotlight much more than like the Special Forces or other special operations units. And so, yeah, it's part of their culture. And there's guys that are completely against it in the SEAL community. And yeah, as a community, as a special operations community, we kind of give them shit for it, because essentially they're taking these missions and writing stories and divulging a lot of information. But you know, some of it can be good, some of it can be inspirational. You know, there's I've read plenty of books from SEALs that were great. But some people do have a biased opinion, for sure.
But I get what you're saying, and also it's fun to make fun of people.
It is.
Yeah. So it's fun to do that. But like, as a layman, Todd
Goggins,
like, bless him. But as a layman, isn't it fun? Like, isn't it great that we get to hear these stories? Like, so many of these movies were written by Hollywood directors in the past. And don't get me wrong, they were great. Rambo. I don't think they had a lot of Special Forces, you know, consultation in that. But, you know, we enjoyed it.
Saving
and also,
Saving Private Ryan.
Saving Ryan's
Private.
Let's
go private for a third time there.
Yeah.
That was a good one. I don't think that was written by a SEAL.
No, but I feel like they would have had a lot of military, because that was very close to, I mean, you know, people would watch that and feel very affected by it.
Well, yeah. Lone Survivor was the big one that, like, kind of broke through and a lot of people read. And, you know, it was a very inspiring book. And so that was the story of Marcus Luttrell and his SEAL team that went out on patrol, basically were compromised, and the mission turned upside down. You know, all of them died except for Marcus Luttrell, who ended up in a village in Afghanistan. And, you know, I have buddies that went in and basically saved his ass that were on the Ranger teams. But
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was a time in the war where, you know, no one really knew what was going on for these missions. And so, you know, they definitely highlighted the reality of what it's like to be in combat in small unit teams in Afghanistan and Iraq. So, but yeah, that was like kind of the big one, I think, that first came out that people really paid attention to. And then it just kind of became the norm for guys to get out and write books.
But there's value to it too, to some degree, right? As long as, I guess 100%. The stigma is like, oh, you're just doing this for money. But then, well, there can be a combination.
Andy,
of like,
you know, Andy Stumpf, he's been on the Rogan podcast a bunch. He lives
squirrel suit.
He's a squirrel suit guy. He lives up in Whitefish, and I think he said on a Rogan podcast that he's like picked up books in a library, and he's read about missions that he was on, and he's like, I don't even know this guy, you know. So like, it's interesting.
So they embellish.
Maybe.
Well, it's Hollywood, dude.
Yeah.
Writing a book, you have to embellish something.
There's a lot of controversy and politics behind The Lone Survivor. Not Lone Survivor, the Chris Kyle book. So, like, there is a chapter or a scene in the book where Jesse Ventura gets involved. And apparently Jesse Ventura is in a bar and, like, knocks out Chris Kyle. And, like,
love Jesse Ventura.
And Jesse Ventura maintains that never happened. And there's speculation that, like, the publicist for Chris Kyle and his foundation basically just threw that in the book. And I don't know if that's true or not. I don't really care. But, you know, it is the nuance of all
this. Well, think about it. You're talking about it right now, so it worked. Good job, publicist.
Yeah.
Hello. You got to get, I mean, bad news is good news. Infamous, you know, makes people infamous when you make something up. It reminds me of when Playboy, to this day, you probably never get an answer from Cooper Hefner, which is, he's the son of Hugh. When they went in and said, we're not going to show boobs anymore.
Yeah.
Or full frontal in Playboy. And everyone was talking about it. It was in the news for weeks and months.
Yeah.
And then they came out with this first issue and there was no titties. And then all of a sudden, everyone's in an uproar. Still, everyone's talking about it. Everyone's still buying it because it's all over the news. And then, yeah. What is it, like 2 months later, they start showing titties again.
Yeah,
it's fucking brilliant idea.
Yeah, it's like a juxtaposition because it's like, all right, what you're saying is true. And like you're trying to sit back and go, okay, I'm relying for this information to be solid and,
right.
and accurate. So, yeah, and it goes back to like, hey, you know what? You believe what you want to believe, but also know that like the truth may not be the truth.
Right.
I feel like a story. Look, stand-up comedians make things up. Right?
Yeah.
They do, and it's like the one place where a lie is not that important.
It has to fit the narrative.
It's about how good
the
story is. Yeah. But the joke is the joke. What you're going for is laughter, mm-hmm. right? So you can say it was you. I went into a bar and this happened to me. Or
sometimes the story is better that way.
However, I feel like really you're going to have enough stories if you do those sorts of crazy military things, and you can lean on that. Yeah. Like,
oh yeah, if you get five, you know, veterans in a room and start telling stories, there's bound to be a story that a guy kind of adopts on his own and kind of recreates. It's just a thing, especially when you add booze and like, it's just fun. And, you know, I may have been fucking victim of it myself, but yeah, it's, there's a lot of cool stories that come from the military that are unlike anything that you're going to experience in the civilian world. And they're fun to tell. I mean, they really are.
Yeah, I like
it. Well, or you, I mean, that reminded me when you're speaking to comedians, Adam, it's like Bert Kreischer, the machine story, you know that's real. There's no way. I mean, he might have embellished a small amount, but I don't think he did. I really don't.
It feels like he really did that.
That story's true.
Yeah. I think what he did is he took a real story and he worked it on stage. And it doesn't mean that he...
embellished.
Necessarily made things up.
Yeah.
But he lent on the bits that really connected. So he emphasized those. And that's really what I mean. I mean, you know, I'm sure anyone in the Special Forces has a lot of crazy stories that are probably really difficult to retell or relive. And if you look at it through the lens of not just a stand-up, but like as a writer, you can turn up the bits that really are going to connect with people and keep it really true to what it was and maximize the hell out of it. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's way more interesting than most people's lives.
Well, and the other part that's, I think, really crucial to talk about is that if you take 10 people and put them on a combat mission and then you get them in a room 2 weeks later, everybody's going to have a completely different perspective of what actually happened.
That's a good point.
They've talked about that in psychology with like car wrecks. You know, it's like you take the victim of one vehicle and you take the victim of another. Like they may really believe what they're saying was true.
Eyewitness testimony is mostly bullshit.
I was going to say that. I was going to say eyewitness testimony. Yeah,
it's all over the place.
It's
because
such bullshit.
You, I think people will certainly just live out or have in their brain what they want to happen and what they want to say happen. And so it's really interesting how the human brain works with that.
Especially if you get somebody on camera or if you get somebody who's writing a book and they want it to, you know, be better.
Well, that's why you have like fact checking, right? Like this fact checking, like, I don't know if you guys have listened to or read Green Lights by Matthew McConaughey, but like people are really giving him a lot of shit right now because they're like, none of those stories are true. Hmm. I mean, they're pretty outlandish, but like, I don't know. When I listened to it, I was like, dude, they're fucking hilarious and they're fun. And like, I loved hearing the stories. So who knows if they're true? He told one story about his dad. He had this like parakeet and parakeet died in the toilet, drowned. And his dad came home and like put the bird's head in his mouth and gave him mouth to mouth and the parakeet came back to life.
Oh boy.
And it's like, I don't know. I mean, did that happen? It was fun to talk about, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What do we know about birds? Maybe they can be kind of dead in water for a while.
Yeah, maybe they were sleeping.
I like to believe that Matthew McConaughey tells the truth.
Yeah.
You know,
he's that cool.
His ability to tell stories and just how cool he is, I just want to believe him.
Yeah,
I agree. But that does bring up a point. They started talking about ChatGPT-4 and what happens when you get ChatGPT-5 and 6 and 7 and how you could... I mean, I'm looking at both of you guys. You got a little smirk on your face because we've all used ChatGPT and it's fucking amazing.
No. It's fun.
It's great. So
I don't know how to
once we get to version 5, 6, and 7, at the very least, and Joe mentioned this, it's great scaffolding to start from as a writer. Like, yeah. So if James wants to, or Jack, sorry, if Carr wants to write something and he's a little bit stuck, there's already people who are putting into ChatGPT-4, what's the next Jack Carr book how's it going to start?
Right.
Party people are doing this.
It could save him a lot of time.
Yeah.
Someone might even write it for him.
But
you have ghostwriters for a reason. Now it's just ChatGPT 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's already been the ghostwriter for Tom Clancy books. And he got to meet him, right? And Tom Clancy was like, I like your style. I'm getting old.
No, that was a different guy. That was a different guy.
Okay. So, yeah. Who was that writer? Can you remember?
Oh, gosh.
It's John Grisham.
He was on a few months ago.
Fuck.
Can't think of his name.
I get him mixed up.
Different guy.
But, like, take that, for example,
Dr.
right?
Seuss.
So he goes on. He's ghostwriting for him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Tom Clancy is like, I'm getting old. I need to chill. But you like my style, and you can come in and do this as well. But not when they started.
His wife asked him to do it, right? And then had him in over to their house.
But it was before Clancy was dead. They worked together for a while.
And I think, I don't know if I'm 100% on this, but I believe most Tom Clancy books are ghost written by other people. I'm pretty sure he wrote a few, but I think they used his name and brand, and like, you know, 80 out of 100 books are ghost written.
Aaron, we're going to need you to fact check over there.
Conspiracy theory.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
But here's why I'm not disbelieving that right now. Is it that it was pretty close to like military stuff that he wouldn't have known about, and you were picking up on that, Aaron?
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm looking that up right now.
All right, we're gonna look that up.
All right. Well, can we turn over?
But in the same sense of what it is, it's like, well, why not? Ultimately, we want the best book. Yeah. I think they want to make the best book.
Of course,
they're already using computers and spell check and whatever. It's like, how? Well, then, at what point is it not you anymore?
Well, Clancy could still go in and edit the piss out of it. I mean, look, I art direct. I like to have designers get it to about 70%, right? That's great scaffolding to start from. Then I go in and fix it. That's what professionals do. I mean, look at in the art world. You look at, Andy Warhol, okay? He would have people making all of his art for him. By the end of it, they were doing all of his screen prints for him. He was just coming up with the idea, and then everyone else was making his art for him.
Yeah.
That's how professionals do it.
That's how you can do it.
If you want to make the moolah. But can we start on the Miller? Can we just go back to the very beginning, the Miller Lite ad? I got to point this out.
Yeah.
Because I'm just
going to... Where are we going with this?
Well, I'm going to throw this out there. But I don't give a... I really don't care about the Bud Light thing. I think it's silly. I think it's a waste of time to talk about. If Bud Light wants to put a trans person on their can, whatever. Again, this goes back to the Playboy thing. Everyone is talking about Bud Light now. Good for them. It worked.
Okay. No, their sales are down like 25%,
okay,
bro.
So maybe it didn't work. So they had a good idea to like come in and be like, yeah, we fucked up, right? What did they say? They pointed out they should just have the guy in the hangover, whereas the next morning he's like, honey, we fucked up bad. Yeah. We're sorry.
If that was their next commercial, they could come back.
That's what Jack
100%.
said. That's what Jack said.
Yeah, 100%. Like, they could come
back. But now you have Miller Lite doing this ad, which... Yeah, I didn't agree with at all. No. And the whole compost thing, if you watch the ad, they're talking about how women were the first ones to make beer. I don't know if that's true. Don't care. That's awesome if they were. They're smarter than men, so I get it. They probably were. But then we took all the fucking, you know,
kudos for it all.
And we drank it all. But now they're going to take old ads of Miller Lite and they're going to turn it into compost. And you got all these, we were joking about this earlier, like you're going to turn old newspaper ads and ads from magazines into compost. You got all this fucking ink on the paper and it's like
all these
toxic
chemicals. Yeah, there's
like
no way
they're gonna turn that into compost to make better fucking hops.
They're gonna burn that shit.
You can't.
That is the biggest greenwashing campaign. It just pissed me off.
Well, I feel bad for hot chicks. Are we hating on hot chicks?
Well, again, it's like the Sports Illustrated
thing. They're people too, Todd.
It well Let me go. Come back to my point. I don't even know if I have a point here, other than it's upsetting to think that that there's nothing wrong with looking good in a bikini, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, being a bigger woman who maybe most people don't think looks as good in a bikini. I don't know. It depends on your preference. Some people like big butts. I'm not a big butt guy. Whatever. To each their own. But don't sit here and make me feel bad for liking hot women in a bikini. Is what I'm getting after. Does that make me an asshole?
Yes.
It does? Okay.
No.
But like, I don't want to see Martha Stewart on fucking Sports Illustrated. Sorry. Who wants to see that?
Yeah.
A bunch of old women are like, yeah, powerful. That's so great. Sorry.
Cool.
I don't care. It's Sports Illustrated.
It's a technique.
It's Sports Illustrated.
They're trying things out, and I don't think it's going
to
work.
And I'm not trying to be Jordan Peterson, because I know you got a bunch of shit for this. I think it's beautiful to show a heavier set woman in a bikini. Fine. I'm not going to buy that magazine, but fine. If that empowers women, that's great. And I just look at it this way. Don't make other people feel better. Like, what about all the women that were in those ads who had a great time, who looked hot in bikinis, and were getting paid a shit ton of money by Miller Lite to be in their ads and were fucking stoked?
Yeah.
We're going to sit here and say, fuck those women? Because that's it. When I'm seeing this ad, I'm thinking to myself, there's some 70-year-old who was in that Miller Lite ad who looked damn good in a bikini in the 80s and is like, fuck these bitches.
Yeah.
I looked good in the 80s. Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
I was getting paid well. I was drinking Miller Lite.
Well, my big thing is,
you know,
okay,
like,
that was
I
us.
I just don't get it.
That was us. That was our culture. Sure, it may be time to move on.
Okay.
Okay.
But don't
fill it full of this shaming.
This woke
and
thing.
This woke bullshit. And, you know, they've just gone overboard.
You're right. It's a shaming thing. That's
it's
what
a
I
shaming,
mean.
It's a shaming campaign.
So now these women who looked good in bikinis in the 80s and were having fun and getting paid are now supposed to feel bad?
Well, here's what I say is if that's not what's supposed to happen, then don't get in those ads right now. Don't get in a bikini and take your picture and attach it to a beer.
Right. I guess I just don't understand. Maybe I'm just old, you know. I'm in my 40s now, but, you know, I met my wife on a photo shoot for an ad. Okay. She looked great in a bikini, still does. Okay. And friends of ours looked at that and were like, I felt like she was getting shamed for it.
She
was getting shamed for it by other women being like, oh my God, I can't believe she did
jealous.
That. We went out, she got paid to do an ad. Yeah. She was a model. She was getting paid to do this ad that I was directing for the magazine. We met and, you know, got married fucking 3 years later or whatever. But we met on that photo shoot. And she was just having fun with, there was three other girls in the ad. They were all having fun. They were getting paid well. It's not like we're not paying these people.
Well, so this ties into a conversation.
This is a thing that's very close to my heart because I've been in these advertising deals before where we're taking photos for magazines. And
it sells.
They were getting paid. They were having fun. They wanted to do it.
Yeah. So my wife and I were having this conversation the other night. So I've been on this like fitness journey where I look good with my shirt off now. And there's
you do, baby.
There was a long time where I didn't. And I'm fucking proud of that.
Yeah.
And so
you should be.
I've had people come up to me, bars, restaurants, public, and say, "Damn, you've been doing a lot of work. You've been like on this wellness journey." And you know, my wife said, "Yeah, it's just not kosher anymore to compliment people on their physique."
I don't get it.
And I said, "What?" I said, "It's so validating for someone to come up to me and say, 'Hey man, you've been working out. Like, you look good.'" And the narrative now, apparently, is that saying that infers that you looked bad before, and it's
right. It's not fair to the people that still maybe be overweight.
It's not fair to the people who haven't put all the work in to look good with their shirt off or in a bikini. And I just don't understand it.
I don't get it either. It's like, don't trust a skinny cook, okay?
Yeah.
There's something there. It's like, if you don't trust a doctor who eats shitty food and is overweight.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
And is telling you how to do things. I think they actually brought this up in the conversation about psychiatrists, you know, a lot of people being coaches, and you're a coach,
yeah,
so you get it, but you live by, you know, a set of rules and standards for yourself. You go to the gym every day. I want to be coached by somebody like that. I don't want to be coached by someone who's always nervous and always anxious. I know a lot of people out there who pretend to be coaches who have about zero self-esteem. I don't want to be those.
No.
I don't want to be those people's mentors.
No, and it's like as I start my organization, which is action-oriented, right? So if I have a company called Action-Oriented and I have a picture of me and I'm a fat ass on my website, do you think people are going to come do my retreats? Do you think people are going to trust me to take them into the woods for multi-day experiences? No. And I've worked really hard, and Adam and I have talked about this before. It's what everyone wants, and that's why it sells. Sex sells, you know, bikinis sell, people with their shirts off sell, because when people look at them, that's what they want for themselves. Yeah. And for people that put the work in, like, celebrate that.
Yeah, you should celebrate. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong.
You don't have to objectify women or objectify men to celebrate it and say, oh, wow, dude, that person is really disciplined.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if the question is the people that don't look as good, that struggle with their body, feel picked on or left out or whatever, it should be, well, let's find a new way to encourage them to feel better about themselves in the hope that, you know, maybe they can just feel good to go on a beach. You know, don't pick on them.
Yeah.
Leave them to be. But we can't pretend that being healthy and putting the work in and being in really good shape. I mean, look, genetics is a part of it, but a lot of it is just hard work.
Well, what about like these girls that are making like six figures on Instagram just showing their bodies? Like, that's an interesting topic. Like,
all right, I don't think we should get into that one, but.
Well, it's a thing.
It's an interesting topic.
It's an interesting topic.
They make a lot of money.
They make a lot of money.
But beauty is always sold. Look, this is just a new way to sell it.
Beauty is in the high. In the eye of the beholder. Okay?
Bullshit.
It is.
It is. Dude, they can scientifically prove, like, it's symmetry. It's like dimensions of space between eyes and lips and all the rest of it.
I get it.
Then with men, it's just being rich.
The final thing I'll say here is by doing a Miller Lite ad where you're taking old ads of women in bikinis who, you know, again, got paid well, had fun doing it, probably. Whatever. They were models. Issues. It was great. It was the 80s. They were into it. And you're tearing these up. You're literally doing the same thing that you are saying that you're getting made fun of for in the first place.
Well, we're also erasing history, too. It's the same thing as getting rid of all these statues of all these Confederate. You're erasing history and you're canceling culture in hopes that, like, somehow we will wake up to this, like, bigger and better and more.
It's not helping anybody.
No.
It's not helping anybody.
You can't delete culture. You can't delete history in hopes that there will be change.
We can learn from it.
Yeah.
But let's
it's okay that history existed. And look at it how you want to.
Let's move over to Jelly Roll.
No? I think we're probably done for the day.
No. We got 10 minutes to talk about jelly, no?
I do like jelly.
Because he's freaking awesome.
Let's put him in.
Let me go through a few things here because Jelly Roll, I did not realize this man was.
All right, this is going on my overtime paycheck.
Was incarcerated for 6 years. Armed robbery. He said he's like, before I even had pubes, I was holding a gun and basically got talked into it. He's
16 to what, 20?
16 to 20. He had a girlfriend that had a kid while he was in jail. Now he's with his new wife, who now they have custody of this child, a girl who's now, what, like 15 or something, 13? Mm-hmm. Anyway, inspiring story. I really enjoyed him, you know, getting really emotional. Both him and Joe cried on the podcast.
Yeah, well, he cried about his mother.
Just for that alone, it was worth the emotional, you know, turmoil that you could see was happening through, you know, what he experienced. His mother was clearly depressed or had bipolar or something while he was growing up, sat in her room all day. And then when she turned on the music, it changed the whole house.
So he was pulling out the positive parts of his upbringing and overcoming certain things by saying, you know what, my mom had this depression. And what I remember, the gold or the silver lining in that is that I remember when she turned on music, it lit the place up and it changed the energy. And that's why I'm connected to music. And that's why I want to put things out there.
And also that is why he is using music to also help all these juvenile kids. And putting all this money towards, what did he say, when he does a show in Tennessee,
underprivileged youth,
he puts all of the money that he makes off of that one show into these juvenile homes.
And he has Joey Diaz jokes open for his show. He has comedians like that are very close to Rogan. Yeah. You know, he had Doug Stanhope for a long time
yeah.
do a joke, and Doug didn't even know about it. He just took a joke yeah. that he liked, and that opened his show.
Yeah.
And it was just like some wild shit that Doug did. Now yeah. he has Joey Diaz, who is like, are you familiar with
oh,
Joey?
Yeah.
yeah.
Shining example of what these kids should be.
He's a national treasure. A national treasure. So the fact that he has that joke on there, I mean, obviously Jelly has been connected to this like comedy world in his own way. But, you know, hearing when he was crying about his mom and like how she wouldn't get out of bed, and it was just the, all this pain, but there were these tiny moments. Like, as a kid, connecting with your parents, even if you have lunatic ones, it's like that you just want to be loved by them. Yeah. Right, you want to be their best friend,
yeah,
like in a way,
yeah,
and to have those tiny moments that speak to you, and then of course he went down that road. It's like this is the only thing that connected with me.
The music and its reality too.
So beautiful,
yeah, yeah. That it was a powerful one, and you know I had never heard of Jelly Roll before. I'm not gonna lie, I didn't know who he was. I'd heard
some of his music when I listened to it, but I didn't know anything about his name. I could have never connected it.
Yeah,
so
same here.
Weird,
great songs.
Weird coincidence. On the way to work this morning, there was an interview on 96.7, which I think is out of New York, but it's a Bozeman radio station. They play an hour of this dude every day. It's like Somebody in the Morning, Tom in the Morning. Anyway, Jelly Roll was on the show this morning.
No,
they
shit.
They played his newest song. As I'm driving to work, I'm literally like
fuck
still
yeah.
listening to yeah. the podcast, and my kid was in the back seat, so I didn't have I wasn't listening to the podcast. I was just listening to the radio, and Jelly Roll was on.
Dude.
And so that was a weird coincidence, but I gotta say, wasn't a huge fan of the country song that came out. Maybe it'll grow on me. I don't know. He seems like more of a hip-hop artist.
You're not much of a bumpkin anyway.
I know. I like, dude, I love Waylon Jennings. Okay. I fucking love David Allen Cole.
It's a different style of country.
I love Merle Haggard. I love Johnny Cash.
Dude, he has
I
some bangers,
love
though.
Old country.
The outlaw country.
I yeah. love outlaw country. And clearly Jelly Roll is super inspired by outlaw country. So I'm sure I'm going to like the well, album, but the one song, you know, they always pick the one song that's kind of cheesy and poppy.
Yeah.
You know, and it was talking about him praying and how he's not a prayer, he doesn't pray much. It was just a little too churchy country
well,
for me.
What often happens is that an artist puts together, you know, like he said, he wrote like 100 songs. And for whatever reason, the producer says,
1 year, too.
Yeah, the producer says, this is the one that we right. have to highlight. And you don't really get to know much about their music or who they are. And I find myself doing this. If I know someone or if I have a connection to someone and then I hear their music, it makes me appreciate it more.
Yeah.
So I did a wilderness expedition with Jason Mraz. I knew who he was. I'd listened to his music. It was very poppy. You know, it wasn't my style.
Yeah.
And like he in his head wrote a song about the expedition, and like he weaved in everyone's lives into the song.
That's
and
cool.
then we sat on the last day, listened to him play the guitar and sing the song, and like little bits and pieces about every single guy's story. And I was like in tears, like, dude, that's really, there's a lot of depth to that.
Yeah.
And then I started listening to more of his music that was outside of the norm.
And
I'm
you
like,
liked it.
Yeah. I knew his character. I knew who he was. He lit me up by his, you know, his complexity and, yeah. and his depth. So I think there's something to that. And it's like, I've heard people come on the Rogan podcast that I didn't know. And now that I hear them, I'm like, oh, I know a little bit about their lives. There's yeah. a connection there.
No, absolutely. And again, I'm gonna go onto Spotify and I'm gonna listen to Jelly Roll, because great guy. I mean, just super, just powerful, huge heart.
Authentic
dude. I mean, clearly doesn't give a fuck about what people think of him or
no, he's got tattoos on his face.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta love people with tats on their face. Yeah. I mean,
that's going all in.
It's just great. It's yeah. just great. Yeah. You just, you know. And I will say there was one
yeah,
thing.
That's $20,000 on Red. No, that's what that is.
One last thing to mention, which I was interesting, if we're talking about other country artists, that he was saying how Zach Bryan had 700 million streams while
oh
he was still
God.
In the military.
Yeah.
He was just like still, yeah. you know, in the Marines, and he's getting 700 million streams. And, yeah. and he was the second. I think Taylor Swift was the one, the person in front
oh,
of
God.
Him. And then it was Zach Bryan. I mean, come on. And the guy was still in the military.
Yeah.
It's like,
getting paid.
That is the beauty of, and they talk about it quite a bit about, you know, how he got on board with Spotify and all of his, you know, his publisher and publicist or whatever was saying, oh, we got to get some more CDs into Walmart or wherever, or all these places. He's like, fuck that. Not if CDs are going away. We got to figure out what's next.
And I think it's great that these artists are getting away from these record labels that are just trying to control their
whole
lives.
You don't need them anymore.
Dude, this is what happened to Tupac. You know, they get locked into these.
I love how you're bringing it back to Tupac now. Tupac, you know, what happened with Tupac?
Tupac had one of the worst record deals ever. Okay. They controlled his life.
I thought he was on death row.
He only was making money when he was...
death row shot him. Sorry.
Yeah, they hated
him. Sorry.
Wasn't good. But like these early guys were getting locked in and they were making zero money. Like, you know, even Jelly talked about it, 90-10 deals where they're like owing forever.
Yeah.
Remember the Jewel?
Yeah, that was a great podcast.
An amazing podcast. And that made me enjoy her music. Yeah. The fact that she basically lived in a car and turned down $1 million.
She was great. She was great.
Like, but that speaks to
love
it, right?
Canadians.
It's like something doesn't, like, they're creative people. And they got there by following their heart, following their like weird way of being. Like, what feels real to me? What speaks to me? What is talking to me in my gut? And also somebody gives you $1 million. It's like too good to be true.
Yeah.
And it probably is.
It's great.
Have you guys seen the documentary Finding Sugarman?
No.
So it's about this guy named Rodriguez. And he's like very similar to Bob Dylan in his music. And he got a record label, I believe, with like Columbia. And he sold 7 records in the United States. Went back to being like a politician and like a woodworker. And like lived in like a shitty apartment in Detroit. Meanwhile, his record somehow made it over to South Africa. And this is like during apartheid and all this like, you know, unrest in South Africa. And he sold like 17 million records over there. And he didn't even know it.
Whoa.
He had no idea. But his music and like what he was, you know, portraying in his music connected to the people of South Africa. Mm. And this guy did a research project on him and he wanted to find him. And so he reached out to his daughter and like there was just all these weird conspiracies that he had died or lit himself on fire on stage. It was all these like really weird things. And when he met with his daughter, he's like, yeah, I wish I would have got to know him when he was alive. And she's like, yeah, he lives like 2 blocks down. And he went and told him how he goes, you're more popular than Elvis.
And he didn't know? Was Columbia just taking the music or taking all the money?
No, Columbia just like didn't promote him in the right way or whatever. And people didn't connect with him in the first like whatever iteration of his record. But like he became a superstar. And then he went on tour in South Africa.
Cool.
And he's like a superstar.
It's awesome.
It's a pretty cool documentary.
Love it. Well, I'm gonna stream some Jelly Roll tonight. What up? Because he is a good man. I heard he's coming to Bozeman, actually.
Dude, let's go watch it.
He'd be great for me at Bozeman.
We got to go.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks a lot, fuckers.
Yeah. Great
appreciate
to be here. Good to have you, Aaron.
Yeah.
And audience, we appreciate you, too.
Peace out.
We will talk to you next week.
Love
you.
Lots of love.